Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, who assesses the impact federal food stamp cuts will have on 1.7 million Americans. Representative John Sarbanes, Democrat of Maryland, who talks about why he believes his Government by the People Act, proposed as a counter to the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling, may get a more favorable hearing in Congress than previous similar bills. And Brett Hartle of the Center for Biological Diversity, who warns about a current effort led by House Republicans to dismantle key elements of the Federal Endangered Species Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the insurgency in Colombia hit its peak in 2003 and 2004, coffee farmers in the northern Perija Mountains fled the violence caused by the five-decades-long conflict between leftist rebels, the army, and right-wing paramilitary groups. A decade later, farmers and their families are slowly returning to rebuild their lives. Through decades of violence in Colombia, over 3.9 million people fled their homes, impacting close to 10% of the entire population of the South American country. To support returning local farmers, the National Coffee Growers Association teamed up with the government of the Netherlands and various foundations to fund a targeted initiative for sustainable coffee growing. The initiative gave free seeds to 600 farmers to replant coffee crops, along with advice from teams of social workers, nutritionists, and agronomists. By 2011, nearly 6,000 acres of coffee was back in production. Colombia now harvests the world's fourth largest coffee crop. How to bring millions of war refugees back home is a critical question now as the government and leftist FARC guerrillas are in Havana trying to negotiate a lasting peace accord. The initiative helping coffee farmers in the Perija Mountains could be one guide for reconciliation in Colombia. Chicago's Cook County Medical Center, whose trauma center is one of the busiest in the United States, treats over 2,000 patients a year from gunshot and knife wounds. Recently, research found over 40% of the trauma victims suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Cook County's trauma team sent a proposal to the medical center to spend $200,000 a year to hire a new staff to identify patients at risk for PTSD and to connect victims with local treatment programs. But hospital administrators rejected the plan. The hospital maintained a small staff consisting of a chaplain, a social worker, and a few interns to reach out to 5,000 patients at risk for PTSD. According to ProPublica, new research has found that rates of PTSD among victims of gun violence have risen to levels similar to U.S. military veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Civilians with trauma wounds can experience flashbacks, nightmares, paranoia, and withdrawal. But few urban hospitals now have the resources to screen for PTSD. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, a promising and forward-looking program called Healing Hurt People reaches victims of violence and teaches patients about the after effects of trauma and how to avoid triggers that might set off PTSD. Years before the January 9th West Virginia chemical spill that poisoned water for 300,000 people in the state, the co-founder of Freedom Industries, owner of the tank farm that leached the toxic chemical MCHM into the Elk River, was in deep trouble. According to Business Week, Carl Kennedy, the co-founder of Freedom Industries, had a long rap sheet, including being convicted of siphoning off payroll tax withholding funds to buy expensive sports cars, a private plane, and real estate in the Bahamas. In 1987, Kennedy was convicted of conspiring to sell cocaine. The three principals in Freedom Industries sold the company just days before the chemical spill. Charleston, West Virginia Mayor Danny Jones observed, quote, "These people who are running Freedom Industries were not the sort of people you put in charge of something like chemical storage that could affect the whole community." The spill revealed once again that lax laws, deregulation, and flawed assumptions about industry self-policing are major obstacles to effective monitoring of dangerous chemicals and to holding irresponsible business owners accountable for their misdeeds. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Surrounded by hay bales and politicians at Michigan State University on February 7th, President Obama signed the federal Farm Bill into law, which will cut $8.6 billion from the federal food stamp program, known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, during the next decade. Along with the cuts, the law provides agribusiness $7 billion in crop insurance and new subsidies for rice and peanut growers. The Farm Bill cuts come on top of $5 billion in funding reductions for food stamps last year, and Congress's failure to renew emergency federal unemployment benefits for 1.3 million Americans, which expired on December 28th. While Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said he didn't expect the cut of about 1% of the food stamp budget to have a significant impact on recipients, advocates for the nation's poor disagreed. According to the Congressional Budget Office, cuts to the food stamp program are expected to affect about 1.7 million people across 15 states, where 850,000 households would lose an average of $90 per month in benefits. Since 2006, food banks around the country have seen a 50% increase in the number of Americans requesting food aid. Now, with the new cuts to the food stamp program, many charities that operate food pantries are bracing for yet more demand for basic food supplies, which many say they will be unable to meet. Your reporter spoke with Joel Berg, author of the book All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America, who serves as the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. Here he assesses the impact of food stamp cuts on the poor and the broader public policy debate on addressing hunger in America.
Well, really, our country has lost its mind and its soul. Not to be too dramatic about it, but it's just true. We know exactly what works in fighting hunger because in the late 1970s, when we created more living wage jobs and ensured an adequate safety net, we almost entirely ended hunger in America. And we've just gone backwards since then, starting with the Reagan-era set of myths that uncoordinated private charities could solve problems that government should be solving. And so right now, we are having the largest cuts in SNAP in food stamps in a generation. And instead of increasing the program to help families buy more nutritious food, buy a fuller allotment of food, and instead of paying for that by cutting corporate welfare, we're actually doing reverse. We're cutting funding for poor people's programs to fund more corporate welfare, sort of Robin Hood in reverse.
Joel, if you could put it in concrete terms, what kinds of meals are people going to be missing as a result of these cuts? You know, in terms of children, who make up a large part of the numbers of people who depend on SNAPs, food stamps, to eat each and every day.
Well, look, children are half the recipients of SNAP benefits. So if you lose $35 a month as these cuts already went through, that's a good 20 meals. Much less you're going to have. Now, there are still other ways of getting help, some soup kitchens and food pantries and school lunch for kids and the WIC program, but WIC was cut back by the sequestration. So, we are taught as Americans, we're socialized into thinking that there's always going to be some Frank Capra-esque happy ending. The banker's going to feel guilty and give back the money, or the food company's going to come in and have a huge delivery at the end. Generally, that's not what happens. There are not happy endings. What happens if we don't fight back successfully in the political system is poor people suffer most. They'll have fewer meals. They'll go hungrier. The greatest irony of all is they'll become obese, because obesity and hunger are flip sides of the same malnutrition coin.
Joel, what you hear from Democrats who supported this bill to cut food stamps is that the Republicans were demanding something like $39 billion in cuts over the next 10 years. So they see this as somehow the lesser of the two evils. What would you say about the Democrats' position here on the food stamp cuts? Could they have done anything differently given the position of House Republicans who more deeply wanted to cut?
That position of the Democrats is nothing short of a cop-out. Today, Democrats are theoretically in charge of the U.S. Senate and in charge of the White House, and why they think they have to settle every single dispute with the lowest common denominator of something marginally less insane than the most insane position of a minority position within a minority party is really beyond me. The people who sunk our economic ship should not be complaining that we're giving life preservers to the drowning, and we should spend more money on food stamps. It's good for the economy, prevents hunger, helps kids do well in school, and the Democrats should have proposed more spending. There's no question the Republicans are worse. There's no question the Republicans did bigger cuts, but we've lowered the bar so much. You know, an ant couldn't crawl under that bar. And we've got to raise the bar instead of saying, you know, boy, if there's some extra extremists on that side, then we can only be extreme with two extras, and somehow that's common sense.
And what could be done, you know, from your point of view as an activist on this issue, what can be done to try to affect change, to reverse these cuts?
We need to build a movement of low-income people around the country. There are 47 million people who need to utilize SNAP benefits. If you add together every member of a union and every anti-union group, every NRA member and every handgun control group, every right-to-life group and every pro-choice group, they're not going to add up to 47 million people. So we need to organize low-income people and not just expect that non-poor people are going to feel guilty and say, oh, my goodness, this is bad. Let me pay more in taxes so my neighbors don't starve. I think first and foremost we have to remember that no social movement in the history of the world has been won by one people on behalf of another, and that's one of the things we're doing at the New York City Coalition Against Hunger, is to organize low-income people to speak out on their own behalf, and I think we need to do that nationwide.
That was Joel Berg, Executive Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and author of the book All You Can Eat, How Hungry is America? Find links to more views on food stamp cuts and poverty in America on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 5th, 128 members of Congress introduced the Government by the People Act in the U.S. House of Representatives. Among that number was only one lonely Republican, Walter Jones of North Carolina. The bill is a response to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision of January 2010, which declared that corporations are people and money is a form of protected free speech which may not be regulated by government. The proposed Government by the People Act creates the Freedom from Influence Fund that matches contributions of up to $150 to participating candidates on a 6-to-1 basis. It provides a $25 refundable tax credit for small contributions and enhanced matching funds in the final 60 days of a general election campaign. The Act also institutes what it calls people PACs, or small donor committees, that aggregate the voices and power of ordinary citizens to counter wealthy donors. Two previous bills designed to rein in the impact of unlimited millions of dollars being spent by corporations in elections did not get far in Congress. But John Sarbanes, a Democratic representative from Maryland, the main sponsor of the Government by the People Act, spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about why he believes the environment in Congress to pass such legislation may be more favorable now than in the past, though he also thinks his bill is unlikely to win passage in this current session of Congress.
We're ready to move forward from this point. We're really at the starting gate now of, I think, an effort to build momentum across the country among the public that is very angry and fed up with Washington and would like to see major change to the way campaigns are funded. And we think we can build that momentum and sustain it so that when the window of opportunity presents itself to bring a bill like this to a vote and be successful, we'll be ready to take advantage of that. We've been working with our colleagues for almost 2 years in pulling this bill together. It reflects that there are many outside organizations that are part of a really unprecedented coalition that have also been pushing hard on members of Congress to join this effort.
Do you see any changes over the past couple of years that might make your bill more successful than a couple of previous bills that were introduced to respond to Citizens United, but, you know, they really didn't get much traction?
People are increasingly angry at this sense that they can't be heard in Washington, that they're being left out, their voices are being rolled over by super PACs and big money interests here. And any polling you do, I mean, they just recently did polling in the last couple of weeks, and in free response, the biggest problem people cited was government. And so there's a real, I think, cynicism out there and distrust that government is really working for the people. And the challenge for us is, where do we take that anger and that sense of frustration?
John Sarbanes, please describe what's in your bill.
It does three things. It creates what we call the My Voice Tax Credit, which is a $25 tax credit available for contributions to congressional campaigns, and this would empower everyday citizens to participate in campaigns and the funding side of campaigns, and I think be very empowering for them. Secondly, it establishes the Freedom from Influence Matching Fund. That's what we're calling it, which is matching dollars that come in behind those small contributions and amplify them, boost up the voice of everyday citizens. And that combination of the tax credit plus the matching fund can really drive contributions so that candidates can raise sufficient dollars to run a viable campaign. And that's what will make them turn to the public. And the third piece is, we wanted to make sure that good candidates who participate in a system like this don't get wiped off the map in the final days of a campaign. So for participating candidates, there's going to be some additional resources they can access in the last 60 days in the home stretch of a general election campaign to help keep their voice in the game if super PACs or other outside groups come into that race. And so the combination of those three things, I think, really empowers everyday citizens to feel that their voice counts, that it matters.
Just on that last piece, I live in Connecticut, and we passed campaign finance reform several years ago, but there have been some recent changes that weaken it. The original law included extra payments if another candidate not using public financing came in with a lot of spending, and that was declared unconstitutional, or in any case, a court decided that it was not permitted. So isn't your third point the same?
It's like it, but we structured it so that it passes constitutional muster. And the way we do that is we don't differentiate on who can access those additional dollars in the last portion of the campaign. So regardless of whether a super PAC is coming after you or not, you can still pull the trigger on that additional support. But the way we've structured it is, a candidate who chooses to do that will have to meet some additional requirements. And as a result, we think the ones that will actually take advantage of it are the ones who really are in danger from the super PAC spending. So we've managed to avoid the constitutional issue, but still make it available some meaningful support for candidates in that last stage. But it's a good question, and it's something that we made sure we took a look at.
You mentioned these other grassroots groups that are organizing around this issue. Is your hope that groups and individuals who live in Republican districts can pressure their representatives to support this legislation?
We have all the traditional good government groups are part of this effort, the Common Causes of the World and Public Campaign and Public Citizen and so forth. And you'd expect to see them there, and they've been leaders for decades. But now we have organizations like the NAACP, Sierra Club, and Communication Workers of America, and other labor organizations that are also coming to this effort because they've recognized that the change they want to see on behalf of their members is being thwarted by the influence of big money. And so they need to make reforming the way campaigns are funded a part of their advocacy. And it's the presence of groups like that who can bring to bear, I think, significant pressure in districts all across the country that will help us build additional support for this within the chamber. I also want to mention that polling data suggests that a majority of Republicans want to see this kind of change. And as a result, I think you'll see Republicans in Congress, even if they don't embrace our bill or sign on to our bill, they will be putting forward proposals that reinforce the narrative of our bill. And in that sense, we'll give additional momentum to it.
That was Democratic Representative John Sarbanes of Maryland, the main sponsor of the Government by the People Act, which was introduced in Congress on February 5th. For more information on the proposed bill, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
The Federal Endangered Species Act, signed into law by President Richard Nixon in December 1973, has succeeded in saving many species during its four-decade lifespan, including the bald eagle, American alligator, and the gray whale. The act currently protects more than 1,500 plants, insects, mammals, birds, reptiles, and other creatures. But now a group of 13 House Republicans are proposing to dismantle key elements of the law with potential deadly consequences for threatened species in North America. These proposed changes would limit citizens' ability to hold the government accountable for effective enforcement of the Endangered Species Act and give politicians more power than scientists in determining how the act should be administered. Many environmental and conservation groups strongly oppose the GOP's reform measures, warning that these changes would ultimately reduce protections for species and lead to more extinctions. During the Act's 40 years of enforcement, business interests have often challenged the law, where it was thought to cut into corporate profits. Logging interests, for example, have long complained about federal protection of the northern spotted owl. Federal wildlife officials are now considering extending protections to more than 250 additional species, including the endangered greater sage grouse in 11 western states, which would impose development restrictions opposed by the oil and gas industries and agribusiness companies. Your reporter spoke with Brett Hartle, Endangered Species Policy Director with the Center for Biological Diversity, who talks about the GOP assault on the Endangered Species Act and the potential impact on threatened wildlife.
This past week on February 4th, Doc Hastings and 12 other sort of self-appointed, very conservative Tea Party members of the House of Representatives released a report. It's kind of a loose use of the term report, outlining a set of recommendations that they would like to see made to the Endangered Species Act, which they claim would reform it, but in reality would most likely gut the most important provisions of the law. And, you know, the reality is that since the beginning of the Endangered Species Act just over 40 years ago, individual citizens, environmental groups, even, frankly, you know, state governments have played a really constructive role identifying species that are declining in this country that need protection under the Endangered Species Act. And they have been the ones that have pushed the Fish and Wildlife Service to protect species under the Act almost since the beginning. So this report, MASCA's reform, seeks to basically limit citizen involvement and citizen participation in the Endangered Species Act. And it's really, it's disguised as, what it really is I think, an industry effort to limit the reach of the Endangered Species Act. So, you know, as you're probably well aware, there are lots of state governments that have recently been taken over by, you know, the Tea Party and other conservative Republican, the wing of that Republican Party, who, you know, have been seeking to undermine environmental protections at the state level and the local level as well. So we see this as sort of a coordinated effort to limit environmental protections for endangered species nationwide.
Brett, what exactly are the Republicans proposing here in the House, and how would it affect federal protection of some endangered species?
Sure. So, you know, this report is quite long, and a lot of the details are kind of, you know, in the weeds. But from a big picture perspective, the goal of this entire report and strategy has always been basically delay. It has been sort of the approach that the Republicans have taken to push back against endangered species getting protection. So in the mid-90s, when the Republicans took over the Congress, they eliminated all funding to list any new species under the ESA for just over a year, in between 1995 and 1996. And they've limited the ability to spend money through a variety of, you know, sort of wonky policy measures in the appropriations bills each year. And this report sort of follows that theme. One sort of easy-to-understand example is the report says that a species cannot be listed or protected under the Endangered Species Act until the Fish and Wildlife Service completes a recovery plan for that species. Now, that may sound at some level like not a terrible idea, but the reality is that assembling the data and figuring out what is needed for recovery of a species that you know is declining is not an easy task. And most recovery plans are implemented, you know, years, if not decades after listing, because it's actually such a complicated question about how to stop the decline of an endangered species and recover it. So this provision, which may seem at first glance intuitive, in reality would have the effect of delaying protections for hundreds of species for many, many years. And as long as a species is not officially listed or protected, then, you know, industry development can proceed without sort of paying attention to the potential environmental impacts.
Brett, as you examine the support for these changes to the Endangered Species Act, can you point to particular corporations or industries that are backing these measures and what their benefit is if the Endangered Species Act were to be gutted, so to speak?
I don't want to point to a specific company, but I would say that protecting endangered species, there are some very obvious examples that have been sort of classic in the sense of, you know, the usual suspects on either side. I mean, the oil and gas industries in the U.S., see an incredible opportunity, especially on public lands in the western U.S. with advances in fracking and other shale gas techniques. And there are some wide-ranging species that are declining very rapidly, like the sage grouse and the lesser prairie chicken of Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas. That would be, I think, significantly harmed if these reforms were to go through. The timber industry has been trying to log the last old-growth forests of the Pacific Northwest for a long time, and the Doc Hastings report singles out the spotted owl as sort of the perpetual reason that our forest industries are declining in the U.S., ignoring basically the entire global trade phenomenon that really changed the markets. And I think the final, big one, which is hard to sort of, pin on anything, is in the Northwest, the Pacific salmon are a very difficult species because of all the dams and all of the other threats to them. And there's always this tension between supplying hydroelectric power and cheap water for farming and not considering the in-stream effects of radically changing all these water bodies. So but there are these general tensions that we see that are driving this, but those are sort of the big three.
That was Brett Hartle, Endangered Species Policy Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. For more information on efforts to undermine the Endangered Species Act, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.